Actually, I just want to sort of take a minute and just, you know, you took us way into the deep end of the pool on that. I think I just would like to everybody just to take a little bit of time to let that last piece sink in. I know for myself, I'm going, there were some questions that were answered, but at the same time, I'm still off over there working on the tail end of that last breath, so I'm kind of, okay.
Want to stretch?
That'd be a great idea.
Sound good?
Sell it. So, going from sitting receptive meditation to standing active meditation. Put your hands up. Then let them drop down. And exhale as you go. Bring them to the center. And take a deep breath. All the way in, breathe into your tailbone. Stretch out. As you come down, let go. Okay. Hi, welcome back. As James and Rick were giving their talks this morning, I've had a recurrent realization of the incredible depth and sophistication of what they were saying. My part in this is to maybe do a little neuroanatomy and sort of give you some idea about how a Western neurologist would understand some of this. And in a funny way, what I'm looking at from the neuroanatomy seems very simple compared to with what Rick and James were talking about. I think first off, let's start from the sense in the neuroanatomy. A lot of times we think about when we talk about these experiences that we're talking about the brain as though it sits up here in the skull in some kind of isolated sense. And that's actually not the case. We should be thinking about the nervous system. Okay? And the nervous system is as tall as me and as wide as me. And extends out to the tips of my fingers, extends out to the tips of my toes, then there is a constant and consistent, always active information handling system that is both doing directive information on what to do and receptive information on what is going on. So you'll have to think of sensory inputs. You'll have to think of the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic side, which I'll talk about a little bit more here in a minute. You have to think about all the various other sense organs, vision, smell, taste, hearing, all of those systems. And then the beautiful way in which the Buddhist nervous system taxonomy includes the mind as a sense organ, which is actually probably a very good way to think about it, because it has lots and lots of inputs to the next moment based on memory, habit, genetics. So if I start to use the term the brain, or if I start to talk about the nervous system, it's not that I'm going to be locked in here. I'm going to be thinking about the whole system as it exists. It's the way that the system evolved in terms of, you look at the evolution of nervous systems through life, you start from actually a membrane. If you look at single-celled animals like a paramecium under a microscope, and you see all these little cilia, and they're going beep, 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 and they're driving the cell towards something. And then it comes up against either a chemical gradient that it doesn't like or a sharp object, and what you will see is it comes back, and then it makes a turn, and then heads off in another direction. Very, very simple, you did this on their drive here today. You know, you're very, trillions of cells making essentially the same decision. Oh, do not run into that car. Okay, drive next. So at an elemental cellular level, at the level of the membrane, information about the external environment versus the internal milieu, what I want versus what is out there, where I am going, all of that stuff happens literally at the level of a single cell. And then you go forward and forward, and you get multicellular organisms, you get various levels of complexity in terms of the reactivity to the environment. And you've probably all seen sort of the concept of the triune brain, the three kind of parts to our brain that has been out in neurophysiology for a long time. Basically, at the brain, come back here. At the brain stem level, and perhaps including some areas around the hypothalamus, you have the very reactive reptilian brain. Okay, best sort of imaged as how a crocodile handles things, which is, or, oh my God! And it is incredibly quick, it is incredibly reactive. There is perhaps, the crocodiles have evolved a while, but the basic idea of that brain is that it takes the immediate stimulus and makes an internal response, and there's not a whole lot of thought in between stimulus and response. There's a lot of hardwired reactivity. Nature gets real brutal in there because the hardwiring and reactivity of whether or not you survived to pass your genes on to the next generation depends upon whether that immediate reflex, almost knee-jerk reaction, was successful in avoiding the stick or grabbing the carrot, as Rick was talking about a little bit earlier. So what evolved out of that system was a bunch of interneurons that begin to start to say, okay, here's that incoming stimulus. What's that really mean? You know, is that really a threat? Is that really, or is that really food? Is that opportunity to mate? Is that a competitor who's threatening to take over my territory? And so you get greater and greater and greater complexity. In the legacy of the animals that led to us, you have what's called the paleomammalian brain or the limbic system. And this is where you begin to get the beginnings of emotional reactions. It is the inside just above the level of the corpus callosum, the cingulate cortex, which runs down there. You're talking about areas in the hippocampus, in the temporal lobes on both sides that begin to have memory storage, and you begin to have the beginnings of the correlation of observing a thing and beginning to remember how that relates to what it was in the past and be able to judge whether this is like that was. Okay. That system is actually, in terms of the Teflon Velcro analogy that Rick talked about a while back, that system is probably where a lot of that Teflon Velcro stuff happens. Because it is also a highly reactive, slightly more sophisticated version of determining whether things are threat or opportunity. The major region that we can talk about fairly easily is a structure called the amygdala. Amygdala is the Latin for almond. It's about that size and shape. You have two of them. One sits in front of the left temporal lobe. One sits in front of the right temporal lobe. These are the structures that give affective loading to memory. So that when you remember something, you remember the feeling tone. You literally, to some extent, to put a Dharmic sense on it, that's probably a major piece of the Vedana of experience comes right in through the amygdala. And Vedana is just whether something positive, negative, or neutral. It's that initial faint tendril of emotional tone to an experience. It is, I like this, I don't like this, at some just kind of very, very basic level. That's not talking about intensity. That's not talking about whether it's really agony or exhilarating. It's just, is it positive, negative, or neutral? That literally starts coming in through the amygdala. Probably about 70% of the amygdala is loaded for negative affect, warning signals, sympathetic activation, time to get the hell out of here kind of stuff.
What percent?
70. About 2/3. So, and it makes sense. We've all had the experience, you're walking down the path in the forest, you see a curved shape, you jump and then look and see it's a stick and not the snake you thought that we were going to step on. And that's universal to humans. We have probably a programmed-in primate aversion to snakes, because when we were wee little small primates, you know, umpteen million years ago, they were eating us, not the other way around. And so that's kind of that's probably kind of coded in there. And then layered on top of, so that's the paleomammalian or the limbic system, and kind of one of the things that happens. And then layered on top of that, particularly in humans, is the neomammalian system, which is this big elaboration of folded cortex that's the frontal lobes and the temporal lobes. And that is basically the, if you think about it, that basically is the simulation system for us. It's greater and greater complexity in the processing of what goes on, greater and greater complexity in the subtlety with which one is going to respond to that. And it is the thing that does the if this then that, which is the 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake up and something happened the day before and you're going, oh, God. What do I do? Okay, well, if I say this to him, then that will happen. And then if that goes on, then this will think. And, oh, well, this will happen. And then, wait a minute, let me go back here. And we've all had that, right? Particularly when we are talking about hard things, when we are talking about bad experiences, when we have had cancer given to us over the phone as our diagnosis or the diagnosis of a loved one, when we are told, when we walk in thinking that, I'm not quite remembering people's names as well as I thought, and you walk out with the diagnosis that the doctor says you got Alzheimer's disease. These are the kinds of stuff that, that all of a sudden, that whole obsessional, to borrow your phrase from your early comment, that whole obsessional, what am I going to do about this? What is going to happen to me? This whole simulation system is something that the cortex runs tremendously. Why would we have something like that? Why would we want to, why would evolution run us into a system where we make all kinds of simulations and simulations and simulations? It turns out that just like the speed of the cheetah, and just like the strength of the lion or the size and social structure of the elephant system, this is our evolutionary success story. This is how we got to 8 billion people on the planet, because we can do this, because we can, in our thought processes, create, all kinds of different alternatives and seek a different path. This is both our greatest weakness, okay? This is dukkha in the extreme. This is one of the reasons that we suffer. This is actually the neurologic substrate for the second dart. It is the repetitive quality of the story that we retell ourselves and retell ourselves and retell ourselves about what happened and how he did and how she did, and this was taken from me and this is robbed from me, and if I had this to do over, I would say it differently. That's or I would do something differently, or I wouldn't have gone there, and oh my God, I did go there. That's the cortex just running its shtick. And doing it. And at the same time, what it allows you to do is to create the situation through some of the practices, like the compassion practices that Rick was just leading you to, that the next time the event arises, you have the opportunity to choose a different direction. James was talking about the self-critical mind coming in and just yelling, you schmuck. And other things that I can't say from the teacher's seat, and it gives you the opportunity to go, okay, judging mind. Oh God, here you are again, poor judging mind. You're really good sometimes, but today's not a good day for you. Would you go away? That it gives us the opportunity in running these simulations and in learning from either our verbal communication from teachers like this or from reading or from our own practices, different ways of operating. I wanted to go back to a little bit because as a neurologist, I see a lot of people who come into my office with second DART issues. Lots of motor vehicle accidents out there. Maybe some of you have been in them. The people who present to with car accidents to a neurologist's office on an outpatient basis are not the hitters. They are the hitties. You know, 99% of the people who walk into my office with chronic headaches and debility and I can't remember and I'm depressed and I've lost my appetite, and you know, they're the people that were rear-ended. I'm sitting at the stoplight. Something can always happen. Bam. And they go from, you know, from considering their shopping list and thinking about what they were going to do to having to deal with the fact that they were just jerked. Their muscles, which were not prepared for the experience, have just been put through a 15 to 20 mile an hour impact. They've been then thrown forward. Maybe they hit the car in front of them. And that just suddenly happened to them. Now, I don't see them the next day. They're going to the emergency room if they have anything. And they get a CT scan and they get a workup and they are told that the CT scan doesn't show any brain trauma and the cervical spine shows that you have the amount of arthritis that one would expect in a 60-year-old man. And, you know, they get all of that kind of stuff. They're given a nice little pat on the shoulder and they're sent maybe given a little bit of Vicodin told to go home, relax, it'll be all better in the morning. And then 6 months later, they show up with me. And what has been going on? This is all second DART. The initial DART was being hit. The second DART is, damn it, all this insurance company hassle, all of this stuff with my neck aches, and I'm going to chiropractors now, and you know, and I've got an attorney. And I've got thousands and thousands of dollars in medical bills and insurance bills, and that person is suing me because they said they did this or I did this or did that. And you have this entire elaborated story, which does nothing but perpetuate the suffering. Now, that's not saying that the suffering didn't happen. That's not saying that the motor vehicle accident didn't happen. That's not saying that the muscles and ligaments in the neck weren't injured. That's not saying that that 3 pounds of tofu that we call our central nervous system brain part wasn't thrown against some hard object at a rapid rate of speed. And if you want to know what happens to your brain in a car accident, take some tofu, throw it at the wall at the impact speed. It ain't pretty. So... but this whole second DART piece perpetuates. Now, what's going on? Some of this is the flight, fright, flight response coupled with memory and run back through the amygdala. Here I am again. I rerun the accident. That thing is a nightmare. Your brain does not know, in all honesty, whether or not, unless the circuits are very, very clear, and in these kinds of situations they're not, your brain doesn't know that the simulation you just ran on the motor vehicle accident isn't the real thing and you're not just going right back through it. As far as that neural circuitry is concerned, these same neurons get activated in the same sequence and the same autonomic and emotional and hormonal kinds of responses get activated. So here you are, self-torturing. And the biggest piece that I have to do as a neurologist handling people with post-concussion syndrome is to gently pull them back from this self-torturing piece without denying the truth of what happened to them. And it's this real interesting dance to have to try to do. Now, that's an example wrapped around motor vehicle accident. There's another condition that commonly walks into my office, which is fibromyalgia. Fibromyalgia 15, 20 years ago was thought to be a psychiatric disease, largely in women who, of course, were hysteric and not appropriately responsive to their true station in life. Yada, 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 yada. But some interesting things have been found out about fibromyalgia, which is that if you have a relative with fibromyalgia, and that's a first degree relative, mom, dad, sister, brother, you have about 8 times the risk of it yourself. The second thing is that really came home to me about fibromyalgia as an organic condition is I treat patients with multiple sclerosis with drugs called interferons. We give interferon, it makes you feel like you have the flu for 2 days. So I would give patients with multiple sclerosis who had no muscle aches or complaints or fatigue or any of those other kind of things, I'd give them interferon. 2 weeks later, I'd ask them, come back, how you doing? Oh, my muscles ache, I'm sore, I can't, you know. And then the next patient would be a fibromyalgia patient. How are you doing? My muscles ache, I'm sore, I can't, you know. It's the same story. It's the same history. And it was just amazing to me that here I was as a physician trying to heal a particular kind of disease process, and I was giving people symptoms that were very, very similar to a chronic disease state that just perpetuated itself. Well, fibromyalgia is actually a disorder of pain. And you can take that right into dukkha, suffering. In fibromyalgia, it's a disorder probably of sensory pain from the skin and from ligaments and muscles. And when you touch a hot stove and pull back, there are two different kinds of nerve fibers that come in. There's the one that's just the reflex jerking back. And then there's that hot burning sensation that comes a few seconds later. And both of those are going through the spinal cord. And they come in through the spinal cord and they go up and they hit the brain and they go out and they come to conscious awareness. The hot burning sensation is associated also with a little side circuit that goes in and starts activating the sympathetic nervous system and say, injury, 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 injury. Mobilize all of the appropriate responses. There is, in that, so that's sort of the simple way we used to think about sensory input. Now there's a whole bunch of other stuff, which is that there are descending circuits that modulate pain perception. You're all using them now. What's going on in your ischial sit bones with that, in my case, 221 pounds sitting on top of them? What's going on in your heels when you're walking? You suppress, if I took 220 pounds and I put it right there on my heel, and I was not walking, and my central nervous system was not setting itself up to modify, I would say, ow, get that off of my foot. But when I walk, I can stand on my heel, and my brain is suppressing that pain. So there's a descending pathway that goes down in there. That descending pathway in fibromyalgia, is modulated by antidepressants that uptick serotonin and norepinephrine. So antidepressants that change the norepinephrine and serotonin systems in your brain will significantly affect your pain perception. So how does that come in? Well, norepinephrine and dopamine are major reward chemicals, and it turns out that meditation practices such as concentration practice, significantly uptick your norepinephrine and your dopamine. Dopamine essentially is the reward chemical in the brain. Meditation practices, which significantly uptake your sense of personal peace and happiness and joy, increase your own central nervous system's concentrations of norepinephrine and dopamine. Hi there. And those systems are not very specific. They're kind of cascade systems. So you get more norepinephrine and dopamine, you get less pain perception. The pain is still there, but the optional suffering piece starts to go away. You see how that trick is working. We're running. I got about 5 minutes. I want you guys to be able to get to lunch. So it turns out in fibromyalgia, There are two conditions, to just kind of finish that off. There are two conditions called hyperalgesia and allodynia. And hyperalgesia means that a slightly noxious pain perception, the mild Vedana kind of thing, is agony for patients with fibromyalgia. Okay. The second thing is that allodynia is a non-noxious stimulus, a finger on the skin, your hand on your cheek, for some fibromyalgic patients, is perceived as pain. Their pain threshold is shifted so far down that normal sensation can actually be painful. And this is, now I already told you that there's a genetic loading in here. The take-home message in the fact that there's a genetic loading for a disease like fibromyalgia is that we all come with our own pain thresholds. We all come with that DNA-induced difference in pain perception. And we have to wrestle with our own pain perception level. So these practices are not just a one-size-fits-all. They're going to be starting from wherever you can find compassion, whatever that level is that you can do it, and you move it forward. It's not that you're automatically guaranteed that, you know, you take this take two compassion practices and call me in the morning and it'll be all better. No, it ain't happening. But you will move a little bit better down the road. You know, His Holiness actually at a conference at Stanford a week ago last Friday was talking about, you know, in terms of his manifestations of compassion. He said, "Well, I've worked at this a long time and I've gotten a little bit better." I mean, that's his statement about himself. And, you know, I think that's actually his perception. He's so far aware, so much aware of how much further he actually would have to go to actually realize this as a complete, you know, always present and never varying compassion. So perfection is not attainable. So you have this genetic thing. And so that's something to really take home and understand and give yourself forgiveness and be willing to work with where you are. And the idea is just to reduce your own suffering and move yourself a little bit further down the road. There was an fMRI study that was done on normal controls and fibromyalgic patients that showed when you gave a noxious stimulus on the surface of the hand, the sensory cortex on the outside of the brain for the hand lit up. That's not too surprising, okay? We gave a really severe noxious stimulus, something that these volunteers were actually willing to submit to and say, yeah, that really hurts a lot. I wish you the hell you'd stop that. A whole piece of cortex lit up on there. There was in the fibromyalgics, for the light touch, got the same big discharge out in the parietal lobe that you might expect. But there was one other thing, and I think that will bring me to the final concept of some of this neuroanatomy. There's another piece that shows up on the fMRI that the drug company actually didn't notice when they did the study, which is right immediately underneath this lateral cortex out here, folded into the brain is a piece of cortex called the insula. You know, the brain looks like this ram's horn thing. And in between the what's called the Sylvian fissures here, there's a piece of cortex that goes inside. That piece of cortex is responsible for the cortical representation of the internal body state. So when you talk about heart, what are you feeling in your heart? What are you feeling in your gut? What's your gut sense? You know, what are you feeling? What are you feeling in your gonads? What are you feeling in the joints in your muscles? It's actually this this insular cortical region that lights up, because that's the relay station. That's the final common pathway where you actually have that gut sense. Now, doesn't take too much in thinking about that to start saying, okay. So we talk about breathing into the heart and being aware of that, and we oftentimes, I think, in teaching the practices of those things, we talk about doing that intellectual location as though we were actually breathing into the heart or bringing compassion into the heart or taking a conscious or cognitive concept and putting it in our heart or putting it in our gut or putting it into our muscles. What's actually probably happening from the standpoint of a neurologist looking at that is that we are actually activating these insular cortical regions, which are responsible for telling the body about what's going on in the heart. We don't have really good localization for things in there, which is why our heart sense is vague and intuitional. My cortical localization for touching my fingers on my hand is really good. I mean, there's really tight wiring there. if you have a heart attack and your heart starts to lose blood flow and it becomes ischemic, you all of a sudden get a pain down the left arm in many, 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 many people. It's called referred pain. There's nothing going on in the left arm during a heart attack other than the drop in blood flow because your heart ain't pumping. But there's nothing going on in the left arm, but the internal body wiring says this left arm is now affected. Okay? So imagine, let's take that and run that analogy back to what's my heart sense about this experience. It's not really well localized. You kind of have to feel it. It's fuzzy. You're trying to, you literally have to spend some time with that heart sense to try to get a feel from that. Or what's my gut feeling about this situation? We use these terms. But that's actually proper because the brain is actually the same areas that are responsible for those kind of sensations are also involved in the emotional experience. And we're using this to tell us. When you look at, and this will be the final piece on that, when you look at the other things that are in the insular cortex, that's where our mirror neuronal circuitry lives. So my ability to look out and look at you and from the position of your face, the activity in your body, the expressions on your face, the twitching around your eyes, the sensation in which you're holding your body, to pick up the emotional resonance of who you are right now and what you are feeling is based on insular cortical activation of these mirror neuronal systems. Okay. So I'm getting a sense because those mirror neurons, which would be activated in me if I felt like that, because I'm seeing you exhibit what those neurons would be doing in me, I'm going, oh, that must be this. This is a well-honed system in us. Has to be. We grow up in the African savannah. I have got to know that the dude at the other end of the room feels a certain way because he may be detecting the leopard behind me that I don't know about. Or what is he carrying in his hand? Is he coming back with a spear to come get me and take out my family? Or is he bringing home the problem that the hunt failed and we got to go find some other food. You know, and I have to be, we've all had that experience across the crowded room of picking those things up. And that's on the basis of this insular cortical stuff. And so this is kind of the neuroanatomy of compassion. There's actually an underlying structure to this, which you were bequeathed with the 46 chromosome complement that you got when you were conceived. And which has been honed through your life through various different kinds of experiences, and which you can now take into the next 20 milliseconds mind moment and decide what that 20 millisecond mind moment is going to be about.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.